Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
What's good, internet? It's July 28th, 2022, and you're listening to Waypoint Radio episode 497. I'm your host, Rob Zachney, and I'm joined by Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
Renata Price.
Howdy.
Kato's currently somewhere.
Not publishing the podcast.
No. No.
Had to find someone else. Just wandering around the Vice offices with a bunch of WAV files.
Hey, can you turn this into a show?
Help.
You good at the the editing stuff, the premiere?
I just hope that people, after we had that conversation some months back about the Flaming Lips album, that actually what you should do for the podcast this week is not listen to this, noise gates and I'm doing fancy stuff with the audios. Actually, just hear these raw WAV files, burn these.
Yeah.
Put them on a bunch of different MP3 players.
You should
play a WAV file.
Yeah.
I don't know. Put that around your house. And then sync up with time.is to see if you can listen to the podcast in real time. See if you can figure out where the mark in the track is and then get the conversations to line up. It's a fun adventure.
The worst part of it was when I had to go into the office with bundles of WAV files in my arms, and as I was walking through the office, did trip and fall, spilling them everywhere.
Oh, that must have been very comical.
It was really rough in the middle of the office shouting, "My WAV files!"
Oh, man,
and
I sure
just,
hope that...
It was really, it was tough.
I sure hope that road they have running through the middle of the office with the deep puddles, I hope a car didn't drive through it as you fumbled for your WAV files and get you absolutely covered.
Rob, I'll be honest, the road in the middle of the office...
Yeah.
Did in fact have a puddle next to it, and the WAV files got all wet, and so the most recent episode sounds a bit weird. It's because the files got wet. I'm just lucky the pillar didn't bite me again.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to look out for that. That honestly, now that that has happened, I became keenly aware of there's all sorts of slightly scary architecture in this building. Almost as if Vice was not meant to inhabit that space. Speaking of things being under construction, I guess, Patrick, today we sort of, a story came through Bloomberg, Jason Schreier, he done it again. We now have some details about GTA 6, which is very funny, by the way.
He also did the KOTOR stuff this week.
Yeah.
That also already happened yesterday. We're like, hey, isn't it a little weird that the company that has built itself on just porting games, old Star Wars games to the Switch, said we're also going to remake one of the most ambitious and beloved RPGs of all time? What could go wrong? Turns out
many
should have gone wrong. Eternally saying they're going to release that game in 2022, and the developers be like, 2025 at best. Like, wow. That is one of the most striking distances between reality and expectations. But anyway.
That is a very failure to communicate type issue. I guess that just means, I'm going to have to remain spoiler-free on the end of KOTOR. For at least four more years.
Shit, we just had that. I don't know if that game's coming out, buddy.
Might just have to play KOTOR.
If the thought is this game is in shambles, we don't know when it's going to come out, and then you just vaguely hear 2025. I think the thought is there is that if you want to play KOTOR, just go.
Who
play
even
KOTOR.
Knows what the world's going to be like in 2025?
No!
Gather ye Jedi.
We still making games then? Who knows?
Well, they'll probably still be making GTA.
They might.
But it might not be out. Given the track record. But yeah, Patrick, you want to take us through what we now seem to know about GTA 6?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, there's a report in Bloomberg from Jason Schreier, formerly of Kotaku. Yeah, it's an interesting piece that like kind of delves into what we know about the development history of GTA 6 so far. GTA 6, a game that, interestingly, Rockstar, a company that doesn't like to talk about what they're doing. Take-Two, who owns Rockstar, a company that broadly doesn't like to talk about what it's doing because it sort of sells itself as when they arrive, they will be important and they will sell a lot. And that is basically kind of true with a lot of the stuff that they do. And, like, recently, as they were winding down Red Dead Redemption 2's online updates, like, they're going to do maintenance, but they're not going to be doing, like, broad content updates in the way that they have continued to service GTA Online. They finally had to acknowledge, right, yeah, okay, like, no shit, we're making GTA 6. But without any details or, like, a release sort of schedule, just sort of, yes, of course we are making the game that you think we are making because the last game, GTA 5, I believe has sold 165 million copies and is like the second best-selling game of all time. Yes, that is a number. And a lot of that is on the backs of GTA Online, which has been wildly successful since that original game's launch. Anyway, this piece has a lot of like interesting little anecdotes. You know, like for example, it opens with the Cops and Crooks, a multiplayer mode for GTA Online that was in development when George Floyd was murdered, and they went, not gonna do that. And that is like as part of a broader, as this piece gets into, like a newish Rockstar, one in which like by this story's painting, and I it's given some added credibility given the fact that a lot of the stories on Crunch at Rockstar and a lot of the culture stories about Rockstar have also been written by Jason in the past, so he seems to have a pretty good sense of what that company and its organization is like. But you know, GTA is a series that's like, you know, had like transphobic and homophobic jokes. It's like some of that stuff has been erased out of re-releases. It is a company that, was notorious for bragging about crunch. And this story paints a picture of like really wanting to eliminate that, where people, if you work an extra hour, you gain an extra hour. So if you do put in some sense of overtime, even as they're trying to stamp that out, which is part of the reason this game will come out when it comes out, because they went from wanting to apparently model enormous parts of like North and South America and then went, what if we just do Miami and then make cities later? They're like sending people home on time. And like there's specifically a quote here that developers are trying to write the game in a way that they are not punching down. And to illustrate a lot of this is that, you know, quoting the report, the GTA 6 will include a female protagonist for the first time, according to people familiar with the game. The woman, who is Latina, will be one of a pair of leading characters in a story influenced by the bank robbers Bonnie and Clyde, the people said. Developers are also being cautious not to, quote, punch down by making jokes about marginalized groups, the people said, in contrast to previous games. Who's the guy that retired? One of the Hauser brothers, like, left, right? Dan Hauser,
yeah.
Who has been... The Hauser brothers have been, like, the creative leads on these games for quite literally decades. And this one is one where that is no longer the case. It's interesting towards the end of the piece, and then I'll shut up, is that there are quotes from employees who are like, we don't really know who we work for anymore. This isn't the rock star that was like punishing and weird, but you got to work on the biggest games in the world, and so you just would shut up and do your job and be thankful for that. And there's like kind of this tone of like, what even is a GTA game that is not made under those conditions? And that's a really interesting place to be. Doesn't necessarily suggest there are like no problems making games. All game development like is going to have issues, but I don't know. It like, I don't know if it left me in the hopeful tone, but it was made me more interested than I was in the past to just see what does Rockstar, like what even is GTA 6 and what kind of tone does it take? If not, oh, and I will say the one thing they mentioned in here is that
Now, the GTA series claims to satirize America. That is maybe a generous interpretation of the comedic leanings of the GTA series, but in theory, that's what they're going for. And they point out that it's sort of weird to try and satirize America when America itself has become difficult. It's satirizing itself in real time.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I probably that would have me most excited is just the idea of somebody not the Housers, like, taking a swing at one of these crime epics, because the problem is, like, this is not, like, it's not like, oh, I just want to dunk on the Housers. Like, they are not, like, by and large, they were inept at doing pastiches or tributes to the crime films that inspired them. Mm-hmm. Like, GTA was all, like, was always kind of like, what if an absolute dumbass, like, tried to make The Godfather, like, do a fan tribute to The Godfather.
Well, do you think you have a better sense of these, like, tropes and stories than I do? Would it be wrong to say, like, their asses have been exposed on that very point as the technology has, like, gotten more advanced and the storytelling has had to take center stage as opposed to the earlier days of a GTA 3, Vice City, San Andreas, where there was still sort of an enthrallment with, hey, these games are taking stories seriously, they're trying to tell jokes, and also the technology, like the open world part of it, is just completely novel. But then the pivot that happens with 4 specifically is like, hey, we're also great storytellers. We're not just a bunch of homages to things that we thought were cool, like a Scarface.
Yeah, it's funny. I think 4 for me is kind of the crossover point where it is impressive enough what they are doing, and the story is just passable enough that you come away from that feeling like, wow, that was a hell of an experience, even though, like, the satire is completely washed by that point. I do still feel like people love the stories of the Red Dead games. I feel like GTA 5 has fewer, has less adoration for the story told. Like, I do know some people really liked it, but GTA 5, you know, the story of that really is the enduring appeal of GTA Online, right? That, like, mm-hmm. that's the other thing that's flipped here in the last 2 years is arguably the Housers' pitch was, we're going to make these hugely expensive cinematic epics that sort of sell themselves. And now increasingly it's a, like, MMO theme park almost
they scuttled single player DLC for 5 once online took off to such a degree. And even when they've announced
right
what seemed like there was a pretty major, what was the rapper? I don't know if it was Dre. I forget. There was some new music produced for GTA 5. I should not say GTA 5. It was GTA Online, which is connected to GTA 5.
Yeah.
But a lot of people speculate, like, oh, finally, we're going to get some new missions in this game. It's like, no, actually, the thing they're just building for is, in many ways, you could argue probably what GTA 6 is just building a new template for a GTA Online. So, like, you get the city, you get the structure, and sure, there's a story here. It'll be important. It'll be great for the trailers that they want, you know, to sell the game. But if these games are being built in terms of, like, thinking of it as a decade, you're right. It's closer to an MMO in which we are putting down. This is the sequel to GTA Online, and it'll have story. But really, they're just laying the foundations for an online infrastructure that will live on long past the credits rolling.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the transition of even, like, GTA Online, the public consciousness for, like, Place Where My Friends Fucked Around, and that I would occasionally watch them fuck around in, to, like, one of the most vibrant and, like, consistent online role-playing spaces in the industry has been, like, a really fascinating thing to watch. The degrees to which players have organized, like, genuine hierarchies and systems.
You've not watched some of the, like, the non-Rockstar sanctioned role-playing servers that people are doing, like, the shit they're getting up to on the PC, like, you would be shocked to the level of, like, what is going on in some of these servers. And I'd be curious how much of that is
you know, because it's not all sanctioned by Rockstar. It's all just sort of, like, happening, not quite on the periphery, but it is many times, like, the heart of these communities are these people building out their own role-playing infrastructures that are well beyond just, like, collecting cars and mm-hmm. going on heists, which I think, if you were unfamiliar with GTA Online, I would not be shocked if that was your takeaway of, like, yeah, people are just getting online to go shoot each other up. It's like, no, like, they're, like, real cops, and, like, people running, like, a storefront, and, like, that's just what they do, and they're talking to each other through voice chat, and it's just, it's something else.
Yeah, I think it is it's been interesting to see the series is, in some ways, the community has both, it's matured, and, like, for me, the role-playing scene has, like, is an indication that, like, the broader space is maturing into something else. Or if not maturing, because that I think that has a bit more of a value judgment, growing and shifting into something else that I find, like, really fascinating. I am interested in I'll be honest with my history with the series. I never really played GTA 5. My dad was big into GTA 4 because he thought the cars were pretty. And a version of that series that is actively interested in handing storytelling tools over to people and understands the kind of consequences and implications of handing more storytelling tools over to the players is really compelling to me.
Will they do that? I'm not sure they will do that, but I think because these are the most expensive games around, like, they're doing that even if they're not doing that. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, sir, that's actually my question is, like, is one of the reasons it's so fucking vibrant is because the company, when they're laying the foundations, doesn't fully understand how it's going to be used.
Right.
And then it kind of ends up in a state of, like, benign neglect where people just, like, because so much is, like, left to the players to define, they end up defining it along a lot of, like, really interesting paths. And I do kind of wonder, will the magic... Like, is it, like, one of those things where the minute Rockstar realizes, like, hey, we can reach for this, it'll dissolve into a puff of smoke, right? Where it's, like to a degree, like, part of it is just it needs to be, it actually does, like, benefit from being a sandbox for that community, as opposed to, like, the minute designers, like, you are sitting there thinking about how do we design this, you know, from the ground up to, like, really emphasize multiplayer, I do kind of wonder, does it then just become another one of these games?
I think as long as there's a PC version, like, it'll just work itself out. True. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know, you're even seeing some of this in what's happening with VR chat, like the very popular VR. Go watch the People Make Games video about VR chat if you don't have a sense of it. It's like a Wild West, you know, online chat platform where just copyright infringement doesn't exist. People be having sex, teenagers be talking. It's just like when all this conversation about what is a metaverse? And it's like, putting aside, like, whether things like WoW and Roblox and Minecraft are already doing that, you jump into VR chat and it's like, this is what you're talking about. Like, when people are like, I could go be another person in a place with just a bunch of tools made by the community to aid what they want to do, something like VR chat is doing that. And then they've just recently implemented things like anti-cheat, which has a, I think, noble goal of trying to shut down things like keyloggers and other malicious things that are happening in the community is not without merit, but it also immediately broke, like, a bunch of accessibility tools and a bunch of other things the community had created for itself. And hopefully that'll work itself out. But if it doesn't, what you saw immediately was someone just pop up a VR chat clone on Steam that just started to skyrocket in popularity. And so that's what's possible on platforms like the PC, where companies can say, well, we're going to do this. And then it'll be like, we'll just work around you, buddy. You just keep building that. You spend those tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars building this really cool looking city with all these tools, and then we'll just do what we want with it. And I think you could see that happening with GTA, regardless of. Now, maybe it raises the floor for people who are not in the. You know, what would be nice is that if there's a little bit what Ren's talking about happens, where, hey, what are people doing in these communities that we want nothing to do with? And the average person is not going to want to have that level of role-playing. They're going to want more authorship and more sort of like the designer intent, like, around their experience. But you would hope that maybe like, hey, if this has been one of the reasons GTA Online has continued to be successful, beyond people just liking to sign on and collect the cars and just, like, it's a hangout place. Like, I don't want to take that away from why that world has been successful, but maybe they're able to take lessons from those communities and bring that into the, like, the basic experience that, you know, 100 million people will experience when they buy this game in its first couple of years. I don't know, but you're right that it's a balancing act, because that's frequently they take the wrong lessons, or don't quite understand what the appeal actually is, or just in the process of having to formulate it into a, like, how do we present this in a PowerPoint and then give it to designers and has it discreetly be put in, like, broken down into rules. That's like a tough process to do, you know, when making a game of this scale.
Mm-hmm. Ren, when VR chat came up, it looks like you had something.
Oh, yeah, I was just thinking about the ways in which, like, it is worth noting that, like, the thing, it breaks, the thing that they did recently with the anti-cheat broke accessibility tools, but, like, effectively, the majority of tools people implemented, like, custom rigging, and a lot of, like, custom rigs in VR chat are built around physics modeling that is not inherent to the game. And people are basically running their own physics modeling systems in order to, like, literally make their avatars look the correct way right. in spaces. And so, like, I think that that is, like, I think it's actually a really great example of the thing that we're talking about, which is that, like, the second corporations touch these things, they evaporate. Because I think, like, the dream of the metaverse, as people understand it, is something that, or, like, the dream of the internet, as people understand it, is something that you cannot effectively monetize very well, because it will always be weird and strange and effectively uncontrollable, and the second you try and apply control to it, the people who are making it work will disappear, because they do not trust you.
The chaos is part of it. The, like, right. slight dangerous elements of it is part of it. Not, you know, it sort of comes with the territory.
It's so funny, like, you said with the custom rigging and stuff, too, because inherent to, like, literally the whole thing in the Snow Crash fantasy is that you go into the space and you can have all the shit you want. You have the avatar you want. You have the gear. You have the abilities, the movesets, whatever that you want. Now, the other angle people come at this by is there's also scarcity. You are the only person that has this shit. Or if you have, like, you know, this piece of gear that is so rare that, like, it is, like, known across the metaverse that, like, you're the person who is the wielder of, like, that faded blade or whatever. And that's how you know, the NFT stuff comes in there as well. But it's very funny that when you have companies who are ostensibly, like, trying to be like, and this is the vision, this is, we're going to bring this stuff into reality, the minute, like, you see, to support that level of, like, wow, this is a cool, vibrant place to hang out in, it's going to have to, like, tools are going to have to, like, disseminate out to a huge community. People have to go wild with it. At which point, though, and this is the thing, everyone's like, I want to do the Snow Crash thing. It won't turn into Snow Crash. It will turn into Second Life. And people who are...
Which is what the GTA role-playing stuff really is. There's like, do you want to do Second Life in GTA?
But,
like,
there's enough thematic guardrails around it, I think, yeah. that, like, there's, like, it's like GTA Online still has, like, sort of consistent... Like, it's still, like, recognizably the thing, and it still has, like, a foundation in GTA. But, like, Second Life, the appeal to it for people who are really, really into it was that it was... Well, there are kind of two things. Like, it's overstated how much it's, like, people just wanted to be, like, having chat sex with weird avatars in Second Life. That gets overstated. But that was part and parcel of just a broader, like, it is a space where you can kind of create whatever. You can create whatever scene, whatever setting, whatever characters.
VR chat's the exact same way, where, like, a lot of the right. headlines center on, look at these furries. Like, they're on here having sex. And, like, sure, let them do what they want. But that is, it is, as you just said, part and parcel with, it is a place where you can make, like, the dream of, like, the metaverse, like, well, like, it could just be the world you wanted to be, because there are things about the world around you and how you look and how you feel and how you represent yourself that you may or not be able to do in your, like,
what?
Physical self. But here, you know, as, like, with the mods, like, with the rigging, like, you could achieve that, or just you
but
could
a company
be a weird
like
looking
Facebook
Sonic.
Can, But a company like Facebook can never do it. Yeah. Because, like, they, like, yes, the minute it's, I think, broadly, I agree with Ren, like, the minute a corporation is involved, like, this gets much, much harder. But I think this specific corporation also, like, when you have a corporation that thinks of things in these sort of, like, colossal planetary scales, you are going to get sort of a temptation for kind of a underfeatured, like, tightly controlled thing that's really antithetical to their goals. But the other aspect of this is that it's always been very funny that, like, Facebook presents itself as the company that can do this, when historically they're profoundly uninnovative company, like, mm-hmm. famously so.
Well, Zuckerberg was very good at sifting through data to identify a company that was about to take off,
right,
and then buying it.
And he had a bankroll and enabled him to do it. Yes,
WhatsApp done. Like, that is, like, a lot of the growth of Facebook in the last decade is not the news feed changes. It is just identifying a company and having the resources to make it part of your own.
Right. They have an exceptional ability to identify companies and then to fuck them up beyond repair.
Unless you're TikTok, and then you are in an existential crisis and unable to figure out, and then you realize maybe I should break one of my own products, like Instagram, a thing people liked quite a bit, and just, you know, tear it down.
It's, God.
I need to actually watch the video where Instagram Peter Dunphy
dude.
I need to watch it because it looks. I just the stills I see from it are just.
I watched 30 seconds and was like, this is so profoundly uncomfortable that I can't actually get to the. Like, I feel like I'm watching a bit.
Basically, the message to Instagram users was, we know you hate the platform now. Mm-hmm. And basically, like, and you're going to have to live with that.
We're sorry, but get fucked. Get fucked. That's the message. God. I mean, it's just wild because Instagram is the place where millennials went, like me, when their parents got on Facebook, and then Facebook became a platform for everyone, and it was like, well, this doesn't feel like I'm hanging out with my friends anymore. Let's go to Instagram. And then that's where people who are 33 to 45, like, spend a lot of their time hanging out and chatting with their friends. And then TikTok comes along and is like, well, how do we change this into... People seem to be watching videos more. Yeah, because you're putting the videos front and center, and I can't avoid them. You've invented a growth metric to explain your priors so you can achieve your goal of breaking this app.
Fucking unforced error. Unforced.
So, on top of that, they're also... they just hiked the price of the Oculus Quest.
Unbelievable. One of the weirdest things I have seen. Facebook, which, like, rebranded, you know, broadly as Meta, as part of this plan to sink the company by Mark Zuckerberg, also rebranded the Oculus Quest 2, probably one of the cooler pieces. I try to strip away the Facebook stuff from it. It's an incredible little device that arrived at an incredible little price that was so clear it was being sold at a tremendous loss. But it was an attempt to do what a lot of these big companies do, which is saturate the market or a lot of these, you know, startups in Silicon Valley do, is like, hey, we are going to not charge anything, get people in the door, and then we'll figure out the money later. Oculus, or I guess Meta, I'm just going to call them the Oculus, fuck Meta. Oculus, they announced, I got to read the actual way they phrase this, because yes, they are increasing the base level price of the Oculus Quest 2 from $299 to $399, and then if you want the larger internal storage, from $399 to $499. And yes, in order to continue investing in moving the VR industry forward for the long term, we are adjusting the price of the Meta Quest 2 headsets starting on August 1st, 2022. But an offer to download Beat Saber, one of the most popular Quest apps, is that no additional cost will come with every new headset purchase for a limited time until the end of December to get the holidays.
They're not even going to give you their duck hunt for the rest of the year.
No. They'll get through the holidays, and that'll be that. As far as I can tell, there is not a concrete instance of a console, a piece of hardware, having its price jacked up mid-cycle. It would not be shocking if you had seen, like, hey, we've been selling the Quest 2 at a crazy loss. The company is hemorrhaging money. Apple passed those pesky privacy measures that asked users, do you want to be tracked? And they mostly said no, and it's now costing us $10 billion a quarter. We got to make more money on these Quest things that are selling actually quite well. That when they got around to the Quest 3, you would suddenly see the price jack up. That's traditionally how you would see that pricing move forward. And they said no to that and said, we're just going to do it right now, and you've got a week to go buy that Quest 2 before that price changes. But it is a, you know, I've you know, someone that really likes VR, but has long abandoned this notion that VR was ever going to sort of establish itself as any sort of like pillar platform. But things like the Quest 2, the vibrant community on the PC, and like Steam, and actually the Quest Store has managed to allow companies to be pretty profitable making, like, the people who get into VR tend to get sticky really fast, and they buy a lot of things. And so if you can get someone in the door on the there's a lot of data on the Quest specifically, that people like go one of two routes. It's like they bought it and they got it for the holidays and they played Beat Saber and then it sits in the corner, or they spend a shitload of money. And they've actually been able to successful selling VR software specifically because of that Quest store. And then it's very easy to link up your Quest to play games on Steam as well. And although it was clear as VR was not going to be the revolution it was hoping for, and was probably just a step on the path to AR, which is going to be more broadly acceptable to people who don't want to have a helmet on their head, as slick as those helmets get and as wireless as those helmets get. And then we end up here where it's like, well, suddenly like $400, like $300 is like pretty palatable to a lot of people. $400 starts getting, I know it's only $100, only $100. But in this economy, it just seems like a great way to start busting up its attempt to even carve out some sort of mainstream relevance for itself in a way that...
I've completely lost track of, like, is Oculus Quest 2 now, like, kind of the lead in terms of just, like, good VR?
It is the market. It is the market. Like, there is the Quest 2... And that long pause is there's nothing else. Okay. You know, like you, things exist like the Valve Index. If you would like to have much higher quality, you know, displays and things like that. Yeah. But even as I have an Index, I got one with Half-Life Alyx, and it looks great. But the Quest 2 is good enough that because VR itself is inconvenient by conception in terms of being able to engage with, the only way, I was like, I'd much rather deal with the good enough fidelity of the Quest 2 and be able to just, like, turn on Steam, have that stream to the headset, or, you know, if it's not, if it has to be, if it can't run, it's like the Quest runs things through, like, a mobile, you know, graphics card and chipsets internally. That's not good enough for some stuff that you'll need to run natively through the Quest Store or Steam. But, like, the Quest is it. And so... And it really took off the last two holidays. Like, it has been a genuine seller. Like, not just like, oh, it's cute, like, which is kind of what the PSVR is. It has genuinely been like, oh, shit. Like, it seemed like VR was, like, kind of headed to the exits. And the Quest 2 kind of saved it in terms of relevancy. And so if you do like the platform, I mean, is that going anywhere? Like, Apple is about to announce some, like, $3,000 VR headset. Who I don't know who that is targeted at, but like I said, I think that's all like on the march towards AR stuff that has VR as a like component of it. But it's just it's weird, it's extremely weird, and just like on its face in the timeline of history, announcing that you were in, as like basically like, hey fuckers, like, haven't you liked that we've taken a loss on this? We're gonna have to put, you know, hike the price. I don't know this for sure, but I can't help but look at this and go, so they recently announced that one of the sticking points for a lot of people, despite how good the Quest 2 as a device, is that you have to log in through a Facebook account. And logging in through a Facebook account rightly raises a lot of ire and suspicion that, the data harvest is upon us. And they recently announced that, hey, we get it. Like, this actual connection with Facebook is turning a lot of people off. We're going to let you just build your own, like, Oculus-specific accounts. After they made everyone merge their accounts into Facebook, which is just makes it so much funnier. Maybe there's a world where, like, they've done the crunch the numbers and actually, like, in order for, like, broader acceptance, they need to, like, get away from, like, the Facebook stuff and the data harvesting. But as a result of that, they have to say goodbye to a shitload of money. And then you see that manifested in an increase in price. That's just speculation on my part. But it would fall in line with the company's, like, cratering stock price, like, continued irrelevance, philosophical flailing. And then you end up with weird-ass moves like this.
I mean, that's why I haven't bought an Oculus. Like, the reason I didn't get a Quest was because it requires a Facebook account, and I refuse to have a Facebook account for many reasons.
Yeah, fair.
But that is the thing that was holding me back, and now they hiked the price $100, and that is...
Well, you've got a week.
take advantage of that week.
But you just got that chair.
That's true. You did get the chair.
The chair has been inquired about. I have not. I know the amount that the chair is going to cost, but I've inquired about a specific chair. And if I don't get that specific chair, I will get another one of that brand of chair. I asked someone for chair recommendations, and I was not just given a brand of chair. I was sent a link to a specific chair. I was sent a link to a specific chair.
Show me this link. Show me this chair.
All right, give me a sec. Let me go to my text.
I am curious because making an inquiry, that sounds like we're already in a different realm that I would.
No, it's a normal chair.
Okay.
It's just being sold for a quarter of market value.
Ah, nice find. Good find.
That's Hey Rob.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
That's how you got to do it. Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely worth camping. Yeah. No, we currently have a little, like, wish list of things that, hey, if this pops up at a Habitat for Humanity Restore thing.
If it's on a marketplace, perchance? Oh, yeah. Perchance I see it on a marketplace?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe. maybe a chair, perchance.
But yeah, I can't understand what this would make now if you're trying to, like, get the Oculus thing under the wire. That could make it tough. So for me, the issues with VR and Oculus and these sorts of peripherals, that sort of leads me to I'm having to look deep inside myself of late. Having to really introspect about my relationship with my racing wheel.
Mm-hmm.
I got code for F1 22 like a week ago for PC, and like it was a very busy week, but also I was like, to play with that, I'm going to have to bust out the wheel. And one right there is kind of an indication of where things stand. Like, one of the issues now is I'm like, I love my racing wheel. I always make sure I have a nice racing wheel. Can't live without that. Since we moved to this place, and this has been an issue, like, for a while, but specifically, like, once we moved here, the biggest issue I've had with my racing wheel is where the fuck to put it when it's not in use, which is always. Like, I'm always like, oh, I want it near my office. I want it near my desk. When I just, like, you know, pop it over and use it. That's never going to happen. And so it's just been a continuing, like, well, where can I put this awkward, like, giant pile of shit that's, like, in the middle of my living room, but also, like, a little bit out of the way, but, like, still near where I can get at it. And then every time I bust it out, it's not as fun to use as I hope. And that really started to... That was me the other night when I was prepping for doing the F1 22 stream. I was like, okay, I'm going to get this all set up. It's Sunday. I'm going to finally bite the bullet, set up the set up the wheel and get this thing ready for stream tomorrow. And I was rapidly reminded. It's like, no, it's not just, like, it's not that you don't like racing, because I'm playing GTA, not GTA, but Gran Turismo 7, like, every day for, like, 6 months. So, like, clearly, like, fully, like, just guzzling, just chugging the good racing. But
sip of race. Not a sip, a chug. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just absolutely. I'm very hydrated with motor oil and, like, power steering fluid. But this, like, setting it up, it's you immediately enter that realm of, like, how many more things do you have to do after you plug it in for it to work properly? And as that number of things increases, my likelihood of engaging with it decreases rapidly. And so I plug the thing in, and I'm like, cool, time to play my racing wheel. Fire up F122. Game starts, and immediately a little message pops up. Hey, you know your Logitech G29? We don't have a profile for that. Sorry. I was like, I don't know what that means. But sure, okay, I'll click past it. And I go to set up the controllers, and it's like, we don't know what you have. Like, maybe some sort of steering wheel? Do you have, like, the Logitech Formula Force by chance? I don't know. And it's like a generic, like, input, and I start, like, mapping to it, and it's impossible to, every single, what I have is it's adapted for a PlayStation, but also works on PC, so it has the PlayStation controls, but when you're mapping all the buttons, and it doesn't have, it has a generic profile, like, arrow pad up will register as, like, that's button 23. Arrow pad down is, like, that's button 22. And so, like, as you're doing key mapping, you're like, I don't even know what I'm mapping anymore. Like, I'm looking at my controls, and I'm like, which of these things did I bind? And it's just, and then I start playing it, and there's no force feedback. It's all fucked up. So clearly something's really busted. And then I remember, like, I've always had issues with these things. If you do not have the specific, like, system tray, like, app running to make these things work. So I'm like, what's Logitech using these days? Logitech's always had some sort of different app to run its shit in the background. Like, if you have a Logitech webcam, you're familiar with the fact that, it like, Logitech webcams are much, much happier if they are being run through a Logitech app. So now Logitech has moved things over to Logitech G Hub.
Yep. And I fucking hate G Hub.
Yeah, you
that's
fire.
A great name. That's a great name. Fucking the Gamer Hub? Is it for gamers?
But it's also for webcams. Pat, it's for everything. It's just G-Hub. It's for if it's Logitech, it goes to the G Hub. And so once I installed the G Hub's like, well, you know, you got to restart the PC and do all this stuff. And this is not like extraordinary, like level, like by sim standards, this is normal. But reboot everything. Go back into F122, and now it's like, hey, that's a Logitech G29. We have a profile for that. And I'm like, I don't understand, like, it was, like, you knew it was there from the start. Like, why didn't the profile load? Why does the game have to talk to the, like, steering wheel through the Logitech app, and otherwise it doesn't work, even though the game knows perfectly well what is plugged in there. Don't fully get it. But all this is, like, that's fine. Like, this is just, like, the baseline hassle of, like, making these things work. Now that I've done that, that's not a task I'm going to have to repeat. But here's where I really start to, like, realize that I'm not sure I can just emotionally and mentally handle what it takes to do sim racing these days. Because everything is designed to be super granular, so you can tailor it and make it feel exactly the way you want. So the steering wheel has just the amount of, like, resistance for, like, wheel weight versus, like, feedback coming from when the tires are under load, etc. And so now that my, like, steering wheel is working, I'm like, okay, time to set this up, and there's still some remapping I have to do. But the main thing is there's, like, a half dozen 100-point sliders for the exact expression of force feedback that you want in the game. And let me tell you up front, the defaults do not feel good. Like, so if you're like, well, that's only if you really want to like customize it. I'm sure, like, you know, you can probably just leave it with the default. No, you can't. You cannot leave it with the defaults, because with the defaults, you're like, why the fuck am I playing with the steering wheel?
See, I feel like I've never been somebody, and obviously it makes sense that people who are like sim heads, like part of the appeal is like tailoring it to like your experience, how you want it to feel. I've had this theory, but also, you know, obviously broadly, like stuff like this doesn't, like, I've never gone down like customized, like hyper specific how the I just in everything in my life, like most of it just sort of like accept at face value, because I worry. I see people like you, and it's like, well, this doesn't feel great, but in the pursuit of trying to make it feel great, am I gonna ruin it for myself in the process? And I just wonder, like, I'm only asking, like, does this speak broadly, more broadly, about like other things, like your mouse, your key, you know what, yes, I mean, like where it's like you suddenly get in your head about, like, well, it doesn't feel good. And where's the line between it doesn't feel good, or I'm telling myself it doesn't feel good? There's actually no line where it's going to feel good. And boy, now we found ourselves in a tough place.
Well, and I think you really have to enjoy the process of this customization. Like,
yeah, that makes sense.
I often think, you know, I'd love to be more like Charlie Hall over Polygon. Charlie loves figuring this shit out and like customizing these things and tuning, and that's fun for him. And so he gets in a lot of like the communities and like niche games and such, and like has the patience to be like, I'm going to build some kind of cool rig that's like special purpose built for this, because he enjoys the process of getting there. I just want the finished thing. You know what I mean? I'm like, man,
that's me. Like, I just give me a couple of options and like, boom, like, and then everything springs into place, and then you're good.
Right, and so this is kind of a curse, is like I have a strong pull toward like niche hobbies,
yeah.
But the hobbies, the end point, like the hobby is actually the journey, and I'm actually, that looks like a great destination. You know, like, how do I get to that destination?
That explains so like, I feel like that line itself explains so much about you and the various things that we cover on your interests, because it is your favorite thing to do. Is discover something you think you'd like to get into, and it's really not about getting into it. It's about thinking about getting into it, and like the journey of discovering what it would mean to get into it. And then maybe you get into it at the end, and maybe.
But
not.
I just want to get to the good thing. That's it's like, man, like I am like I love the idea of like, man, imagine I just start every day with the best cup of like, you know, homemade espresso possible. That would be incredible. Can you
imagine, it's great.
Lux life. But getting to making the best, making a reliably excellent espresso, mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm not sure I would enjoy the process of getting there. And especially the detours I would take, as I was like, well, actually, I'm using the wrong technique. But this is sim racing too, because as I'm doing this, I realize this, I think, more than anything, is why people have those permanent, like, standing sim rigs. Because once you have this, like, once you tune all this stuff, you want to, like, put the entire setup under glass a little bit. And have, like, those apps that control your things like steering wheels and such, you want those all to be on your side. You don't want to even be tuning it through the game necessarily as much. You want, like, the baseline setup to be pretty much exactly where you want it, and then the game sort of, like, fit that. But to get there, it really does make life easier if you have a dedicated setup where everything can be sort of laid out and tuned exactly as you like. Whereas for me, where it's always going to be, like, you know, plug, unplug, you know, like, get the engine turned over for a new game, there's always going to be the stage of like, this doesn't feel right. How do I make it feel good? And the other thing is just the way my brain works. You give me 600 point sliders, I am lost in that level of granularity. Plus,
right.
And that's the other thing is comparing this to GT7 is really instructive as well. Because Gran Turismo is profoundly well-tuned for the PS5 controller, which makes sense. They spent ages working on it. They know everyone's using this controller. And so playing it with the controller is still a more vivid experience than a lot of games I play with the racing wheel, because they did such a good job of like making that control system work and communicate a lot of things that automatically I'm like, wow, this is some of the best racing I've ever experienced. And I know that, like, you know, there's not much point in fussing with stuff. It's great straight out of the gate. And with a game like F1 22, there's all these questions of like really subjective things, where it's like, how stiff do you want the wheel to be by default? How strong do you want the force feedback effects coming from the road surface to be? How strong do you want the force feedback effects coming from curb surfaces to be? How strong do you, like, all these things. But what you're also tuning there is your feedback system for what's happening with the car, for how you control it. And so if you get this stuff wrong, you're going to be getting the wrong prompts. Like, your brain will interpret things poorly. And you will drive poorly because what your steering wheel is telling you is not what the game is trying to tell you, because your settings haven't, like, matched those two things up. GT7, it's clear. Like, the game is telling you exactly what it intends. You can interpret it really reliably. F122, there's this huge error bar, which is, what are your personal settings? And how are you interpreting them? Does this feel right? It's made more complicated by, I don't know what an F1 car feels like. Not really. Like, my experience is always through these fucking games. Like, GT7, because you start with, like, baseline cars, you get a sense of, okay, well, this is what a Honda Fit feels like in this game. I understand, like, how cars like that drive. But I don't know how an F1 car is supposed to feel, so I'm kind of groping through this blindly, trying to get this in place where it feels good. And so, like, my first session with the game was like 4 hours of tuning, and like at that point it's bedtime, you know. It's like, yeah, like, and so I'm like, great, awesome, I guess the thing's sort of ready-ish for stream tomorrow, but like I have now spent my entire night preparing to have fun with this thing, and then also I'm gonna have to take this wheel down, like, you know, soon. Because can't live with it out for that long. So, it's like, F122 has kind of, like, I wouldn't say broken my spirit on sim racing, but, like, it has sort of made me realize, like, shit, like, I don't know that I can keep investing time in this. Or, alternately, maybe what I need is a sim rig. And then I just invest lots of time and money in it. And then, like, if I had all the high-end shit, like then...
Rob, you need a basement first.
I know.
You're not going to... That's not going to happen in the place that you got. That is a quintessential...
I know.
...dad basement feature. And I know a lot of... my neighbor went down that path with GT7, like, when it came out. Like, played with the controller for, like, a night and went, absolutely not. And then just immediately invested in... like a full setup to play that properly, and it's cool as hell. But he at the end of the session can just, and I'm sure these aren't as complicated as some of these custom rigs that people make, but you know, it's in the same ballpark where it's like, just disconnects the USB cord that is connected to the PS5 that is connected to the projector, shoves that off to the side, and like you're all good done. And then just brings that back when, you know, he's ready to engage with it again. And, like, that's what you want, even if it's probably a more higher-end version of that. But I also think it's maybe illustrative of, I don't know, I don't think it's necessarily, like, getting older, but the tension between, like, your hobbyist and, like, how much you want a game to just interpret parts of it for you. And it's interesting to see that illustrated, specifically for someone like you, who I otherwise would have pegged as someone who wants to be in the sliders. And learning that you like a little bit of the sliders, but not, maybe some of those sliders could just interpret what I want them to be, and it just feels good. You know, I mean, that's probably just a broader tension in game design, right? Is like, you know, people think they want to choose things, but actually they just want it to feel good and go from there. And that's,
Well, I mean, yeah, like, you give... I would have thought, and I think historically I have, like, I love lots of granular settings. I love to, like, tailor it just to me. But
that but if you also, don't have the vocabulary for what that even means, then that's functionally useless.
Right. And also, like, what if it all, like, and creating those sort of settings also means you've created a possibility where people can make it bad for themselves. Right. Mm-hmm. And not know it necessarily. So, yeah. So, like, that's like where I'm at with the, just the general, my general relationship to sim racing right now. I have managed to put some time in F122. And I've gotten so much better than I showed on stream. Really, I cannot overstate.
Oh, the quintessential of someone who plays golf is like, well, yeah, you know, when I wasn't playing with you guys, like, just crushing those drives. But I'm just really off my game when you guys are here.
It was brutal what was happening to me on stream. I was twitchy. I was panicky. I got too excited. I overdrove the car. And now that I've spent some time with it, and I've got my sliders a little more right, you know, I'm starting to have some, I'm starting to turn in some really nice laps. And I'm also, so what I did on stream was I went career mode, which isn't too different. When I got off stream, I went back and I was like, I'm just deleting that entire career. I'm not sticking with that. Like, that didn't happen.
That's not me.
No, that's not me. When I got off stream, I did the thing where you create your own team. And it's like franchise mode. But also, you're the driver. And, you know, in the virtual, they have all the commentators from F1 TV and the Sky broadcast in the UK. And so part of it is like, wow, you know, nobody's ever, the driver-owner thing hasn't happened in like 100 years. That's pretty wild. And of course, it never will. It will never happen again because you need to be a billionaire to own a team. And there's just not that many teenagers who have control of $1 billion that they can do that and then would like have the talent to start driving. But anyway, in this fantasy land, you are an owner driver. And, It's funny, like, you make your own team, and you choose things like who's your engine supplier. I went with the worst engine supplier, Renault, because they're cheap, because nobody wants their engines because they're bad. But I figured, I'm a new team, I'm going to have a bad car. So what's it matter if it's got a bad engine? Mm-hmm. I don't need it. I'm just going to waste that good engine. I need to save that $1 million a year so that next year I can build a good car. I looked at the driver market and I was like, wow, there's a lot of up and coming talent from Formula 2. That's great. I don't need a good driver for this car. Because, again, it's a bad car. What I need is a driver who's just very consistent and really thoughtful. And so I picked out a driver who's like, you know, he's not amazing, but he's just like, he's very good as a benchmark. And I'm like, that's what the team needs right now. Just a benchmark. The thing that kind of jumps out at me is this is the most EA of their releases. Like Codemasters was bought by EA. And there are a lot of places where, like, with your customize your driver avatar, or, like, customize your new team, where it sure feels like they are pushing you to remember that, hey, you need to unlock more cosmetics because your default cosmetic options suck. Wouldn't it be great to have good options? Well, maybe you should buy, like, the season pass. And then the progress bar that fills up every time you do something with all those locked icons. Well, now, when that progress bar filled up, those icons would unlock. And you get the stuff that you've unlocked. And so it's very, like, it's grating because this is a, you know, it's a full-price game. And like all sports games now, that just buys you entry into a game that's constantly reminding you, like, well, to have the non-ugly version of this, you need to give us more money and grind a lot, right? It's kind of the twofer. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, do you want to just grind a ton of this game for the purpose of getting stuff? But to even get that stuff, you need to pay for it. You kind of need to pay for it twice. That's kind of where this game is at. In terms of the racing, I mean, it does now feel really, really good. It is very funny that there are a thing they can't solve is, and I guess, you know, this is self-driving car stuff. Of course they can't solve it. When something unexpected happens on the track, the simulation collapses. Because, like, so the AI drivers are capable of some clever tactics. Like, they will defend positions pretty realistically. They will, like, try to make passes fairly realistically. Like, they will recognize when you're moving into a passing line. They will sort of block you, and you sort of spoof them by cutting back over real quick. That stuff's all great. The thing they can't handle, and this happened to me in, like, the first full race I had last night. At the end of this huge, like, long straight at the Bahrain circuit, there's this, like, really tight chicane. And so it starts with a hairpin. A hairpin turn, you have to go from, like, it's, like, 320 kilometers, you know, down to, like, 80 really, really quickly. But there was an accident at this turn. Not even a bad one, just somebody spun out. And I had to watch the replay to see what had happened, because the way I experienced this was I missed the initial incident. But as I came up on it down that straight and I saw the yellow flags, I'm backing off. There is a stack of a half dozen F1 cars that have all, like, piled into one another end to end. Because when the spinoff happened, none of the AI drivers were capable of doing the thing that you'd obviously do, which is, like, I'm going to steer around that accident. They piled, like, the first one piled into it at full speed. And then the others just continued to drive into the back of each other. And so the entire race had this, like, comical, like, five drivers were taken out. And there's only 22 drivers in this field with my fictional team there. So, like, a quarter of the race was wiped out because a car spun. And they all just, like, caused a chain reaction collision. And it's like, that just wouldn't happen. It's just comical that, like, you watch the replay and it's like, wow, the AI drivers have no idea how to handle this really basic situation. And the entire, like, outcome of the race hinges on the fact that, like, a thing that should have caused barely even a yellow flag, like, everyone should have been able to spin and or go around, everyone would have been fine, instead turns into just absolute automotive carnage. And so that, like, it is, they've been making these games for 12 years, and it's just very funny that they've refined a lot of aspects of this experience, but then really basic things about, like, what happens on an F1 course, they still can't get the little guys to react the right way. And so it's very weird. I suspect a lot of people won't necessarily notice, because the nice thing about racing games is they're kind of solitary experiences. It's not like in Madden, when things don't go right, you kind of see the camera cuts to, that guy shouldn't have done that. What the hell is going on there? In a racing game, that doesn't happen. You have to kind of investigate, like, what else was going on. But it was a case where, even from my perspective, I was like, this is really weird. There should not be 12 cars piled into a to a collision here at this point in the race. So yeah, I'm having fun with it. I'm getting my feet wet, but little moments like that just kind of highlight how big a gulf actually lies between the F1 series' ambitions to be, like, a good sports game, and then what their simulation can achieve. I'll probably have more on that as I play a bit more and sort of redeem myself from that atrocious stream. But first, we're gonna take a quick break and read some ads.
Hold up! What was that?
Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, Rob.
Yeah.
Let's rewatch Predator.
Okay.
That new movie's coming out. Prey. It's supposed to be awesome. Like, it's fucking sick.
You know, a real Predator, not the remake.
Well, there's... I mean, look, people claim the Robert Rodriguez Predators is actually pretty legitimate. I did not like it when it came out, but there's been a reappraisal. But all I am suggesting...
Yeah.
...is we should watch Predator and we should watch Prey.
I'm into that.
We should do
that. I love that.
Okay. I will look in. Prey is out August 4th? August 5th. I'll see if we can get it early. I know there are screeners out. But, yeah, let's watch Predator.
Hell yeah. Ren, have you, are you a fan of Predator?
I have not seen any. I have not seen a single frame.
Oh, that's great. That's even
that's
better.
Perfect. That's actually
that's,
perfect.
I'm curious how a movie of that.
So I didn't see it until very recently. Like I saw it
really.
The first
time I was so that was not a childhood.
No,
VHS.
And
that
I was like, this
up.
Looks like the most meathead fucking thing I've ever seen.
You're not wrong. Well, I can,
except
can two things be true.
I am wrong. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, like I'm very curious now, Ren, what you make of it when we delve into this.
Okay. I had a friend growing up who was really into it.
It's yeah. It I wonder if they knew why they were into it. Because again, like it's a very unusual movie.
It was because the guy was had a cool, scary, mean guy who killed. That was why.
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah, it sure does. Yeah, it sure does. Okay, all right. I was browsing tabs and that idea popped in my head.
All right. So, Ren,
hello.
You have been playing Caves of Cthulhu.
Yes.
And you were mentioning before the show that, first, it's been in early access for ages. It feels pretty buttoned up at this point. But you also sort of mentioned that it seems, as these things go, maybe even uniquely good at being a narrative engine.
Yeah, I think that... It does that on a couple of grounds, right?
Hey, what is Caves of Cthulhu?
Right, Caves of Cthulhu. Caves of Cthulhu is a traditional roguelike. We're talking the
oh,
most...
Oh, boy, wow. Okay, I just pulled up some screenshots.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah. This game had ASCII art until, like, two years ago.
Oh, this is a quote from Cameron Kunzelman. Okay, well, a lot of things are slotting into place on this video game.
This game was ASCII art only until about 2 years ago, and I was still, like, fucking around with it then. Caves of Cthulhu is a traditional roguelike set in a wildly vivid world. It is really well done. It feels post-apocalyptic, but also it seems like the world before the post-apocalypse was also strange and like deeply, deeply broken in a way that you would traditionally associate with post-apocalypse. And so it's got this excellent setting that is pulling across, like, the traditional, like, gunslinger to, like, there are cities that are run entirely by bear people who are really into technology. There is a faction of bears who fucking love computers. And so the game is, like, basically a beautiful piece of clockwork in terms of, like, its faction system, in terms of its procedural generation, its procedurally generated quests. It is excellently written. The base level.
Can I read some of these? Please. Do anything you can imagine from the website. Just to, like, paint a picture to some people before you get into your specific stories. Dig a tunnel anywhere in the world. Purchase rare books from an albino ape mayor. Contract a fungal infection and grow glowing mushrooms on your hands. Charm a goat into joining you. Then give him chainmail and a shotgun to equip. Clone yourself. Mind control the clone, hack off your own limbs, and then eat them for sustenance. I feel like that paints a very vivid picture of the spectrum of of stories and adventures you can get up to here.
So, to illustrate how good Caves of Kud has gotten at the thing it is, I'm gonna use a story. So, I started the game as a scholar, a mutated scholar. I imagine this character...
Is this rolled for you? Are you picking this? Like, you're picking. How does the generation happen?
Right, so you start the game. You come to a screen. And there are preset builds, or you can do a build totally of your own.
Is that like you're picking stats, picking the name? Like, okay, all right.
Picking stats, name, mutations. Or if you're an unmutated character, you are picking your cybernetics. So you do stats, you do your class, which gives you a bonus to some stats, and then you might start with some skills at the beginning of the game, and then you get into mutations. And mutations are where things really kind of take off for me with Caves of Kud. So I was playing as a scholar, which is one of the classes that gives a bonus to intelligence, and you have a chance of having books as starting items. Books trade for a lot of money, which in this setting is fresh water. So you are literally drinking money as you travel across the world. And so you start off, I started off with a couple of books and just some real basic mutations. One of them is burgeoning, which meant my character could summon plants. Cool. Some poison ivy shit. Hell yeah. They could coalesce the light around them into a beam. So they basically, their body generated light. And also they could fire light off in a cool, like, laser beam, right? Great. And they were telepathic. So they could talk to someone a distance away. Pretty simple. Not actually super strong mutations across the board. But I gave them a really high ego stat, which is the game's charisma modifier and also what determines the power of your mutations. And then I gave them an ability called Unstable Genome. And what Unstable Genome does is it basically gives you a random mutation that unlocks later in the game. And so basically, partway through your run, you level up and the game is like, hey, so your genome just kind of became deeply unstable. What mutation would you like to manifest? And I had this character manifest Electrical Generation. So there's this, like, bookworm scholar who's, like, traveling across the world totally unprepared, doesn't have a weapon, is kind of just a fucking doofus walking into caves being like, y'all have any books? Hey, can I have a book, please? Most caves don't have books is the problem. They just have people who want to kill you really badly. And so as the game goes on, I start to get stronger over time because your abilities grow with you because at the beginning of the game, your mutations have like a level 1 cap and they're pretty weak. But as you go, you get stronger. And so the scholar is like exploring the world and their mental mutations get stronger and stronger and stronger. Eventually, I got to the point where if I touch an enemy with like an electrical discharge, I could instantly kill things that were like significantly stronger than me level wise. Just like this weird freak walking around. At one point, I found a little watch that needed a battery. Motherfucker, I am the battery. But this accelerated to the point where I'm in this cave. And I'm playing as this little scholar. And I level up, and all of my abilities tick to the next tier. And the game gives me a message. Let me pull up this message. Caves of Kud. Psychic Glimmer. A message shows up on screen. It's a familiar feeling. When someone has watched you in the past, when it's light that betrayed your presence, you made a friend of the darkness. You pulled your hat brim low over your eyes, you stepped behind the cover of a thatched wall, but those who watch you now watch in spite of such simple obstructions. Their sight isn't mediated by the rays of a gleaming star or torch, but by something much older. If there are ways to conceal yourselves from these seeing eyes, if there are new kinds of darknesses to befriend, you know nothing of them. And then I was just supposed to kind of keep going after the game informing me of that as my character touched the psychic maelstrom, became psychically adept enough to touch the sea of thought that exists outside of themselves for the first time. And so you have this scholar who spent their entire life studying, finally getting at the edge of something truly bigger than them, truly massive. And I find this gun called the Ruin of House Isner, which is this pistol, which has this really cool story behind it. It's a really good gun. I'm rolling it. I am killing it. And then this scholar comes into contact with something bigger than them, and he's like, I'm hot shit. I am the best wizard there's ever been. I can fight anybody. Oh, a slumberling? Oh, you're just kind of like a big bear. I can handle a fucking slumberling. I summon plants on you. I electrically discharge on you. This is a 2.5 hour run. It is going so good. And then it headbutts me once and my body fucking crumples. I see -17 come on screen as my character is absolutely shredded by a bear in the middle of a cave because he was a fucking hubristic idiot. He was a dumbass who thought he was super smart and gets crushed in 2 hits by a bear.
To what degree, like, was that you making the choices to, like, continue the roleplay as the dumbass, or had the character also gone off the rails in other ways that were expressed? That, like this character is going to do a heat check that's going to go badly. Is that you as player, like, making that choice, or are there things in the game that are also being like, I'm losing control of this little scholar?
So, making the decision to fight the bear was on me. That was me making a choice because I thought it would be interesting for the character, because I thought it would be funny for the character, because it was like, we're talking like minutes after coming into contact with the psychic maelstrom. He was like, all right, I'm hot shit now. And so that decision was explicit, but the game's story generation itself is really exceptional. Highly entropic beings, like, objects will develop sentience. There are sentient chairs in this world that kind of happen by circumstance, who you can learn things from, and the procedural generation is really, really strong. The game very infrequently takes control away from you, but you actually can determine kind of how much weird shit you want to have happen to you. I mentioned the mutations earlier. There are also negative mutations. Mutations cost points. There are also negative mutations, which give you more points to work with. One of them is, yes, narcolepsy. You could make a 1-to-1 Renata Price. Using Caves of Kud mutation system, you got triple jointed narcoleptic.
What's narcolepsy do in the game?
It, basically, every round there is a very, very small chance that you will fall asleep for 18 to 20 rounds. And so theoretically, you could be just like fall asleep in the middle of a fight. The chance is low, but it is there. And so narcolepsy is considered a relatively intense negative mental mutation in the game's world, because falling asleep in the middle of a fight is dangerous.
When we talk about that moment where the character touches the psychic maelstrom, I'm curious. Mm-hmm. There's stuff that's going to be proc-gen, and then there's going to be stuff that's like seeded throughout the world.
Yes.
And this obviously, that passage is seeded.
Yes.
Now, the challenge for like games that have any sort of narrative element like this, but mm-hmm. Everything I've heard is that it's just so hard to sustain the illusion of like the world is full of wonder and mystery, because like player, like just the sheer amount of content that is required to create mm-hmm. that sense of like, wow, you could stumble across all this stuff at any moment. The world's full of these things. I am curious, do you have the experience a lot of like you're playing it and you're like, you see the same beats a lot, or does it tend to be like when you got that message, was that kind of like was that sort of a flooring you moment as well, where it's like it's completely out of left field from your experience of the game?
Right, so that specific thing happens when your mental mutations hit a certain level of strength.
Yeah.
If the collective level of your mental mutations goes over 20, that is when that happens, but I had never seen that before. I had not had a character who was so fully invested in mental mutations that something like that could have happened to them. And so that did floor me. Finding that revolver I mentioned, the Ruin of House Isner, that is also one of the seeded objects in the game's world. The Ruin of House Isner is a pistol that was basically, it's a seven-chambered revolver. One chamber for each of the sons of House Isner, because it was forged basically for a guy to get revenge. And so it's a seven-chambered revolver with seven slugs. And so that was super sick. The seeded things are very well done. But more than the seeded things, the game actually has a history generation system where basically it will, when you start a new run, the game writes a history for that specific run. There will be a couple of sultans, there will be historical figures who do things, mm-hmm. there will be cults who follow those historical figures, and then those stories are in the setting true. And so stumbling upon parts of those stories and discovering them over time is a key part of the process of, like, building the narrative of the run. And so, you know, there's a couple things that I've come across a few times. One time I came across a painted knife, and that painted knife told the story of a former ruler who took power by assassinating the previous ruler after they issued an edict preventing the bottling of stars. And I found that knife, and it's like, here is one part of the history of this character. Having this knife gives you a better relationship to followers of this particular historical figure, right? But other times, you'll find something that is like, oh, this object has the story written on it of this specific event, and it'll be like, and this event took place at this location, which you now know exists in the world. And then you get a quest that's like, hey, you should try and find that place that's on that knife. You should do that. And then you basically go out into the world, and when you stumble upon a village, you can be like, hey, have you heard of this place? And 9 times out of 10, they'll be like, no, of course I haven't heard of that place. But every once in a while, someone will be like, oh, yeah, if you head up here and over there, you'll find it. And then over the course of run, you're putting together the history of a specific person, and that rules. And, like, the beats are familiar insofar as procedural generation. The process for uncovering procedurally generated information is pretty standardized, but the information which you are finding is pretty unique for that particular character. And that's in addition to the game's just, like, base level, really excellent seeded content.
How, I'm curious now in terms of just the actual playing of the game.
Mm-hmm.
This may be an outdated conception of, mm-hmm. it is an outdated conception of roguelikes, but my experience with them is a lot of times, like, the systems themselves tend to be, like, simple but rugged, mm-hmm. And also, like, just by the nature of the game, it also lends itself to a real risk calculation forward approach to playing the game. It can be a little bit like, to see more of the stuff, you end up, like, spending a lot of time on a run doing really uninteresting things. And so I'm curious, like, how quickly, like, when you've finished making a character and you're mm-hmm. sort of playing around, how long before you start feeling like, oh, I'm on an interesting narrative thread here. I'm seeing some really interesting things, versus you're just kind of out there trying to survive and grind to the point where you can start those bigger forays.
I think it depends a lot on the build that you're doing. This is a game where you can have a huge variety of builds. That scholar I mentioned previously was basically because of that ability to summon plants. Some of the plants in Caves of Khud basically drop tumbling seed pods, which explode and do a ton of damage. And so I was kind of able to roll a lot of the early game, because I would just be like, I'm just going to summon some plants and kind of lure people into my plant trap.
Yeah.
And so that character grew really, really quickly. But generally, death comes pretty quick in Khud. But once you're on a roll, things really start going narratively. So if you get past that first, like, literally 20, 30 minutes, which you can very easily if you want to do a build that is good at that, you will go on a roll pretty fast. Other characters struggle a lot more. I have been trying to, for a little bit now, run a character who, another scholar, who, and scholars don't start off with good weapons, who is not strong, but is very agile, and has the ability to improve their stats, based on how, like, strong their mental mutations are. Great, cool. That is viable, but the thing about the game's damage calculations is that they come fast and hard, mm-hmm. In a way that I actually think is really evocative, and does a excellent job of conveying a mood. And I also think it's like damage rolls have been done to death, but I think this is actually a pretty inventive way of doing damage rolling that gives a ton of color to the world, and kind of lets you predict how bad you're kind of going to get your shit rocked in the early game if you like start to understand it, which lets you kind of skip the more boring bits by being like, okay, cool, I kind of know that I'll get my shit rocked if I go here. Let me go do another interesting thing over here first.
It sounds like the game's in a great place.
It's
so
excellent.
You mentioned that like, it feels pretty buttoned up at this point, feels pretty ready for prime time. I'm curious, where's the development officially at when it comes to that stuff? Are they just going to be content being in early access forever, or is it one of these things where a full release is imminent?
It's pretty much there. That's why I wanted to wrap back around to it, is because it's pretty much feature complete. Let me do some quick counting.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 20. Of their feature arcs that they have, completed 29 of what they call feature arcs in their roadmap. They have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 left. And the 8 left they have are updating the game's UI, which is much better now. It is exceptional how much better it is now than it used to be. Adding the final region of the game. Adding a bunch of, like, accessibility tools, both in terms of, like, accessibility in the, like, disability sense, but also accessibility in the, like, hey, does this game make sense to new people?
Yeah.
Does this game make sense to new people? Systems, which I think they're actually doing a really good job of. The new preset builds are a really excellent series of introductions to the game. The preset builds are kind of ranked by how challenging it will be to survive as them starting off, which I think is a really good way to, and gives you like a rundown of their basic playstyle, which I think is a really good way to get people in. I did a run as the Fire Frond, which is a character who can summon plants and shoot fire. That was like really compelled me and was like, okay, cool. This preset system is really, really strong and interesting. And then two more main quest updates, and then sound and music.
Yeah.
Steam achievements and like quote unquote coloring in the lines. It's just like adding a little bit more content. So it is right at the edge of being done. In terms of like major features though, they've done it and they work and they're sick.
Sounds awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so that's Case of Code. What is that now these days? I had it on Steam a minute ago. What's it cost?
It costs $25? $20?
Yeah. Sounds pretty reasonable for what you're getting. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, so let's take a little dip into the question bucket here. As always, you can send us questions at gaming@vice.com with subject line questions, and we will possibly get to it. Our first email comes from Nathan from San Diego. Greetings, Wabies.
No.
I don't know.
Nah.
The San Diego thing?
Head back to the drawing board, bud.
Yeah. I don't know what's there.
I appreciate the, you know, 6 years in, running out of new ways to do it, you know, on some level. Gotta try.
Absolutely. Nathan asks, what games have you rented or purchased the most number of times? In the 90s and aughts, it was pretty easy to wind up reselling and rebuying a game over and over, or rent a game repeatedly. These days, it seems more like the only real way to repurchase games repeatedly is just to blanket every game platform with your compulsive purchases. For me, it has been Burnout Paradise, which I purchased on Xbox 360, PS3, Steam, PS4, and PS4 digitally. And while I didn't purchase it on PS5, I've re-downloaded it several times, and that has an inkling of the feeling of a compulsive purchase. I love that summer has become bucket season for Waypoint. Thanks for all the laughs and insight you provide, Nathan.
Burnout question for me.
Burnout for Paradise is not a bad one. Like, no, I feel like I've ended up getting that one a lot, too. Between, like, I think I picked it up cheap for my old, like, 360 arcade. And I was like, playing things on the 360 arcade is a nightmare. I'm going to buy it on PC. And then they did the reissue. And I didn't buy it again on PC. At that point, I was like, man, I'll be playing it on the Xbox would be great, because that's now hooked up to the TV, so I ended up getting it for the Xbox in there. So yeah, Burnout Paradise, I think, has had a uniquely, it's very fertile soil for that kind of, like, endless repurchasing.
Well, there hasn't been, and also, there hasn't really been another thing that's attempted. What, there's no Burnout Paradise 2, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. It's an itch that if you want to scratch, the best place to do it is just to go back to Burnout Paradise.
That's, I mean, like, in some ways, they've repeatedly done it again with Need for Speed, but none of it's that, like, it's
no,
so
not
different
really.
From Burnout Paradise.
Yeah, that's such a specific thing that,
yeah.
It's kind of wild that they have not actually just found a way to make a Burnout Paradise 2, especially, like, given the tech these days, it seems like that would be, you know, maybe it was a, you know, a game of a moment, but I think that there are some games that people buy in over and over because it means a lot to them, and they, like, just want, it's like a comfort game that they want close, and it's something to revisit. Burnout Paradise, I'm sure, can be that for some people, but I also think it also crosses over into a territory of just, there's nothing else like it. And if you just want that, like, you've got to keep Burnout Paradise close, because you're just not, there's not, like, not another game for you to boot up and get the same sensation from.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, it has to be Mass Effect 2.
Because
I never bought Mass Effect 2, but I definitely beat Mass Effect 2, which implies to me that I did rent it over the course, multiple times over the course of, like, probably months. That's to be it for me.
Yeah, because that's the closest thing I have, because I just don't play old games again, mm-hmm. broadly, unless it's for research purposes or a stream we're doing. And so the closest I have for that is the exact same situation, Ren, which is just, I love JRPGs. These carts tend to be more expensive than the other ones. I remember seeing, walking down the aisle of Toys R Us, and, you know, like, seeing how much Final Fantasy III was going to cost on the SNES. And so for me, it was a lot of go back to the rental store because I want to play this terrible JRPG, but I'm just going down the list and, like, flipping the boxes. And it's like, that looks like it has turn-based battles. Let's do another one of those. And it's how I ended up playing, like, Tecmo's, like, Secret of the Stars, like a famously awful JRPG on the Super Nintendo. Mm-hmm. But then it became a game of, and we've talked about this before, but yeah, like, hopefully my save's still there. Like, I would write the save as, like, PLZ, don't delete, you know, like, just hope is, like, there's other spaces here, please just, like, put it somewhere else. And, like, that's how I would get through some games long enough to determine if I liked the story or not, was just re-renting the same game, because I feel like the policy was at the family video that we went to was that, like, you could rent it again a second time. Like, hey, you can come back. We'll just rent it to you again. You have to bring it back physically, rent it with us. You can just, like, do it over the phone or, you know, or things like that. But then, like, the second time you had to put it back on the shelf, you had to leave and you had to come back the next day and give someone an opportunity to rent it again. And then I would just try and convince my mom to take us back to see if it was still on the shelf.
I did not have that problem for the most part. I only had that problem with DS games because of my, in terms of like worrying about save data erasure.
I guess you were largely coming into an era in which saves were tied to the console as opposed to the machine or to the game itself. Yeah. But, handhelds being the exception there.
But I did have a version of it, which was my Xbox 360 my grandmother purchased for me, was used, and I only ever got used hard drives. And so I would buy hard drives or Xboxes that still had people's saves on them,
yes.
Which is how, as a child, I rented the original Dark Souls, just hit play on that video game.
Oh, I don't like this at all.
And found myself in Sen's Fortress. I started that game in Sen's Fortress, and that is such a vivid memory for me of booting Dark Souls for the first time and being like, what the fuck is that snake man? And then being just killed by traps over and over again until I decided to start my own save file. It is a deeply vivid memory from my childhood.
That's really interesting. We should just have a feature where people send in their save games and just play them.
I think for me, in terms of just ending up repurchasing things, I think 3 is like my limit. I just don't, because I think in general, once it's on PC, like, it's just gonna be around for ages, so there's not that much like pull to get the stuff on every platform, because PC was my default for so long. So I think 3 is my limit, and I think games that have qualified for that, the original Thief, ended up getting that, ended up getting Thief Gold when that came out, and then buying it years later on like GOG. I think Assassin's Creed 2 ended up following a similar arc where it's like, I got, again, situation where you got it on the Xbox, ended up getting it on PC, and I think I ended up getting it for a later PlayStation as well. But yeah, it's, but like,
I mean, Deus Ex was kind of like that for me, yeah. Where like I play it on the PC Gamer demo disc, play it on the PC that I had. And then, I don't think there was an Xbox version, but they put a PS2 version. And I was like, well, I'm not going to beat it again, but boy, I'd love to at least play through a chunk of it again, just to see how they modified the interface for the PS2 re-release. And so when I got access to Steam, I think I bought it there for $1 just for the novelty of it. So like, I think the closest I have is probably that one, just because I always got so interested in just seeing, well, how is this game mutating on the new platform that it's arriving on?
Oh god, I got a really good one. I don't think I can read it without Kato here though. It touches on, it's a little bit crafty, it's a little artistic, it touches on card games. I don't think I can read it without Kato. I think Kato would be really sad to miss out on this. That's, you know what, I'm gonna move that back into the later column.
It'd be good if you just read the question, but we just declined to answer it.
Oh, it's not a question. It's we must statement. We must look upon someone's works. But man, Kata's not going to be here for ever.
Rob, you can just tool. You can just literally move it, and it will still be there.
I know.
That's the benefit of the tool.
All right, I'll move it. I'll move it off to the side. Okay, so look, someone's got a little. Someone has a question, and I am curious if anyone here does have an answer. But Eric from New Jersey writes, "Dear Waypoint, this is mostly a Rob question. Rob Soul 2B's, not sure what's going on there. Mostly a Rob question, but anybody can feel free to answer." Rob, you're extremely racing-pilled, and you know a ton about cars, but you don't seem like a car guy. I'm not sure if you drive, and if you don't, God bless you. Owning a car sucks and is bad for everybody. But if you do, mm-hmm. what is your dream car? Is there a vehicle you've ever gone to an auction site and very nearly considered adding to your life? Other waypointers, what do you drive or wish you could drive? I very nearly put my meager savings into a bid for an imported Autozam AZ1, and I'm very happy to have not done that, but I still like to dream. What the hell is an Autozam AZ1?
I spent most of my life driving a 2005 Ford Freestyle. Good little car. Well, good medium sized car. That is all I drove, and it is all I really had interest in driving. I never really wanted a new car. I was satisfied with the piece of shit that I was given. And I will stand by that car until the day I die. My sister now drives it.
Oh, it's a fun little wagon.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
I could fit all my friends in there.
Yeah.
And that's what mattered to me.
The other than the like rotating hand-me-downs that I like drove when I was a teenager that I don't really remember. One of them was like a Lexus something or other at a certain point, but. The cars I think of was like the first real car that was mine was a Honda Element, which was like the default car they gave a lot of people at my dad's company, Riddell Sports, the sporting goods company. And they eventually were essentially like doing some downsizing and cost cutting. And they were just going to basically get rid of a bunch of these cars, like sell them for as cheaply as possible to just get them off the books. And my dad was able to step in and acquire two of them for just an like basically pennies, you know, not quite, but like it was like $1,000 to buy it, like just nothing compared to the actual value of it. And the Honda Element, if you look it up, is like just a little, this boxy little thing, but the seats folded back, so it was tiny but spacious. It was like ran like a dream. I don't know what year that car was when we got it, but when we sold it in 2016 as a trade-in, because I got to a point where I brought it to a mechanic and I asked them, okay, I am expecting a child in 4 months. I need you to tell me two versions of what this car needs work on. Version one is if I'm keeping it for the next 5 years. Version two is that I have a pregnant wife in there and I need to keep her safe. I guarantee I will sell this by July 2016. And so he gave me both versions of that. One was like a $500 fix and one was a, you know, like $3,000 fix. And when I turned that in, they were like, as though I'd given the place gold. They're like, this will be gone in 24 hours. I was like, really? Like, this car is like pretty long in the teeth, although it was still in decent condition. They were just like, fucking kids love this car. And I was like, okay. And I like checked in later when we came to pick something up at the dealer. Like, yeah, it's gone. Like, it was here like 36 hours. And they sold it. And then we turned that in to get a Honda CR-V 2011. Mm-hmm. Very reliable. Very good car. It's getting a little cramped. I've talked to Rob multiple times about we like really need to get a second car in the house.
When it comes to the dream car thing, you get your cap is set on a three row car.
The dream car for me in my life at the moment is the three row, like probably hybrid. The electrics are too expensive. I guess electric would be the dream, right? A three row like minivan electric car. That's the dream. Like in the middle is actually more like, I forget what it was called. One of my cousins got it. It's like the Chrysler, something. Yeah. I don't know. It's like a 40 grand car, three row hybrid. You buy it and you get it, you know, 8 months later. But yeah, my what was the Volkswagen one we were
Buzz?
Looking at? Basically they're bringing back the bus as like a three row family car.
Yeah.
It's yellow as shit. It looks awesome, but it's not coming to the U.S. for. Well, I don't know. By the time I can, you know, reasonably afford one of these cars, as I desperately hold on to not buying one, I think of it in like 6 month increments. don't buy it for the next 6 months. And then I just convince myself to try and not do it for another 6 months until there's like a, like the housing market's cooling a little bit. I need that vehicle market to cool just a couple of degrees, and then I can pull the trigger on something. So that's where I'm at. But Rob, I don't know what your answer is going to be, but you've told me tales of a car you have dreamed about getting before. I don't know if that's the same.
Oh,
I don't know if Patrick on the hotel roof is, car is the same as the car you're going to tell, though.
Yeah. So I think I might not bring that one up. because it'd be such a like swinging for the fences type thing, and requires like, if I ever reveal I've acquired that car,
mm-hmm.
it's like I'm confessing to a crime. It's like I'm just waving a flag. This like, investigate this man, investigate him. So in terms of, like, staring at shit on auction sites, I now go to car auction sites just to see what's up and, like, keep track of, like, what the actual market is for cars. Because, like, dealers, like, as I understand it, prices are falling. Prices on dealer sites are not, because they're, like, trying to, like, hold the market up to an extent.
Yeah, but, like as the market is beginning to...
Right. But...
To cool, they're just, like, desperately hoping there are going to be people like me who are just, like...
Yeah.
If I can get the car today instead of waiting 6 months to get it from the manufacturer,
cars,
okay, fine.
Yeah, cars that last winter were, like, low $30,000 cars that have now been, like, $40,000 cars for months. Now you see those listings, and they're just there for months. Those cars are not selling at those prices, but they're being listed at those prices. Mm-hmm. But you go on auction sites, you get a little more of a sense of, like, what the market is. Thing that I was staring at, like, hard... like last week, not far from me, in a town nearby, a 2010 Mazda Speed 3. I have a Mazda 3 from like 2016. The Mazda Speed line is like their performance line of cars. The Speed 3 was like their hot hatch. It had 106,000 miles on it, which sounds bad, but it was $10,000. Had been extensively modified for like racing and had recently had the engine rebuilt. And so even though 106,000 miles on the odometer, like new engine, and like they don't make these anymore, and by all accounts they were like wildly fun. And I was like, you know, I don't think it's an easy sell to be like, let's get rid of our new modern Mazda 3 and get this old less good but like cooler Speed 3 from like 12 years ago. But the thing that sort of like really made that a non-starter was that this is standard on a lot of listings, but it's like, look, if this thing can't pass emissions, that's on you. Like, this is a buyer beware type situation. And Massachusetts emissions are a little bit tricky. And I was like, I would bet you with all those fucking modifications and the rebuilt engine, the odds of that thing passing emissions are low. And like, you know, I could have asked you. The auction sites let you chat with the owner a bit, and I don't think anyone's trying to screw anyone there. But I could see it where it's like, you know, just randomly at some point the car can't pass emissions and you don't know why, and you're just making change after change to the engine of the drivetrain to try and figure out what's going on, and suddenly that awesome hot hatch is not so much fun. I think in terms of like there's a lot of cars that I definitely dream of. I think right now the edge of achievable, but not really, because it was like it's mutually exclusive with like tons of other useful things that I could do with my life instead. But the new like generation, the C8, new generation 8 Corvettes, the C8 look incredible. Look amazing. They're cool cars, and by all accounts are like not far off from like European exotic performance, but at like a fraction of the cost. And so it's like you'd have a little American built like little mini Ferrari in your life. That sounds like a lot of fun. But the deal breaker is, I don't think a two-seater coupe makes, like, what's weird is for a lot of my drives, I don't have a passenger, you know, like, it's fine. It's often just me out there, on the road. But like, man, I would feel like such an asshole that first time where it's like, I'm taking Mina to the park. We're going to go for a big walk. And MK is like, oh, that sounds great. I want to come with. And I'm like, oh, I'm gonna take the coupe up there, and there's no room for you and Mina, so I guess it's fine. I'll take the Mazda. That's no trouble. That's where I would just feel like a complete asshole. Where it's like, all right, like cool, like time to have a cool little drive somewhere. Nobody can come with. Nobody except the dog or MK, but probably not, because if both MK and I go somewhere, the dog has to be cared for. And I would feel weird about just riding around in a Corvette with a dog on our lap, collectively. That seems sketchy. But anyway, yeah, that's probably like up there, on the dream list. Like, even more achievable is, I keep coming back and forth on, like, by all accounts, Chevy's just been on a roll. Like, their Camaros are cool. But I do wonder, everyone says you can't see out of that fucking thing. It's like, it performs like a race car, but you cannot see. And I'm like, but do I need to see?
No, yes. I would say yes. I think performs like a race car and you can't see is, I believe, the worst possible combination.
Yeah, but they got all these sensors now that tell you what you need to know. As long as you can see out the front, you're probably good. Nobody can see out the back anymore. Hardly any cars let you see out the back. That's what collision standards are doing. But yeah, that's where things have ended up on that front. So yeah, like, I think there's more practical answers, and the truth is, all this stuff is, like, I had a brief flirtation with the idea of, like, oh man, it'd be so good to get a cool car. And I've slowly come around to the idea, you know what sounds way cooler than that is maybe buying a different house that's a house and not a apartment size condo.
And then you could, and then you, you know what, Rob? And then you could put your absurd racing rig in it and live out those fantasies.
You get all the cars.
A little bit cheaper.
Yeah. Right.
In the comfort of a home. And you can dream about what you're going to do when you're 65. Well, and then you can be at that auction site.
Yeah, well, by the time I'm 65, it's just like, no, then it's like, I...
That's the point, Rob, because you should never do it.
I know.
And then you could just slowly age into the
into realizing you're not going to do it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But see, the thing is, I want to age into being like, I did that, and that time of my life is over. But I got to do it first. And so that's kind of where I'm like, that's why I need these cars.
That's late 40s, buddy. I think you just give that about 10 years, and you're going to hit a boiling point, and then Rob is going to utter the secret code that he wouldn't say 10 minutes ago into a different microphone. Here's my Rob starting a Kickstarter for him to buy this car.
Oh my God. Okay, and last question, by the way. This is somebody, this is just the direction the question bucket is going. By the way, if people want to write in about games, feel free. We could use more of that. We got tons of coffee and water comments and questions. That stuff's great. And
I feel like we have trended in that direction. Part of like us talking about news a little bit more is like trying to ground in relevance to a degree that maybe we have shifted away from. And so feel free. Don't be scared off from all the questions being weirdo hobbies.
It is not a question.
You could ask, like, what do you think is going to happen in games later this year? Is a perfectly applicable question.
But
also the car I was talking about was the Chrysler Pacifica, which just like the base level non-hybrid 37K, the hybrid 47K. But would you actually like to buy that hybrid 60K? Yeah. If you would like to buy it today at the dealer.
Yeah, I think. By the way, though, I heard they're not making Siennas anymore after this year. But I heard the final build of the Toyota Sienna. Is really good.
I've heard those are good as well. Yeah. Yes.
But yeah, like, man, minivans. What a great concept. We didn't know what we had. We made fun of them too much in the 90s.
Dude, I was in this one of these Chrysler Pacificas, like, on my vacation. It's what my cousin has, and it is... Man, fucking kids have a screen on two different couches, and the screens talk to each other. I played chess with my cousin. It was incredible.
See, this is what the SUV boom took from us. Is that the minivan did all of this in a really practical, versatile, like, format. And then, at best now, the market is turning large, unwieldy SUVs into minivans.
Yes.
But just with a way less convenient, like, form.
What if you had all the space in the world? What if you felt like... What if you were in a mini truck? That's what the minivan promises you.
Yeah. But except it's not like a truck because the floor is lower and you got more of that headroom.
I know.
That's what they fucked up. Anyway, with the caveat that I'm just reading what we're getting. Josh writes, Rob, get into iRacing.
You've never done it before? I feel like this has to be.
I dipped my toe in and I was like, ooh, too hot. Josh writes, hey, Waypointers, especially Rob. Listen to the latest podcast and watching Motorsport.
Also, you know, all right about games. Just a string of questions that all start with, well, here's a question for Rob that I guess other people could weigh in on if they have any esoteric opinions about this esoteric topic. You could also ask questions to the other panelists, perhaps, would maybe be an option for the audience.
Yeah.
Because Rob is theoretically filtering these, but if he's filtering them, they still come out as, here's a question that starts, Dear Rob, but also other Waypointers can answer. Trend in the last two podcasts, just pointing out.
Well, that's two emails, even. Yeah.
Mm.
Listening to the latest podcast and watching Motorsport Mondays has made me revisit this email I've tried to write since Rob was talking about the Daytona 24. I guess what I'd like to say is that every time I hear Rob talk about Forza, Gran Turismo, or real motorsports, I think he'd really like to try out iRacing. I apologize for the length of this email.
Oh, geez, okay.
I'm having a little trouble collecting my thoughts to communicate them on this matter, so I'll just start off with my admittedly unique experience with iRacing, which has ultimately changed my life. Very fundamentally, for the better. I had taken up working out after a brief period of unemployment and stuck with it for over a year and a half and was very impressed with how consistent effort at improving at something had paid off after sticking with it for a long period of time. I know, no great revelation, but as I've gotten older, I'd become a little averse to trying new things when I wasn't immediately good at them. Around this time, I heard you guys talking about a controversy that happened in iRacing and remembered that I had always wanted to try it out. So I set out to try another new thing, to slowly improve at, this time with the intention of documenting my progress. So I dusted off my old Twitch and YouTube channels and started racing. And after my first half season, started making weekly videos about what I had learned the previous week. Time goes by, and I learn from chat, and we start building a little supportive community. Time goes by, we do a few endurance 10-hour to 24-hour races, and I'm having a great time with the stream, all the while working a retail management job. Then, earlier this year, I was asked in Twitch chat by the chief steward of iRacing if I had checked my email that day. I hadn't, so I pulled it up, and it was a message about a job opening. So I replied, and went through the job application process, and now I've got the first job I've had outside of retail. It's a lot harder to explain what a sim racing steward is to people than it is to say, I run the plumbing and electrical departments at a big box store, but I'm thrilled to be working on something that I'm passionate about. I wanted to write to you about iRacing at this time because it was around when Rob was talking about the Daytona 24, but I felt weird when I was going through an interview process. Listening to Rob talk about it, I was setting up the longest races he could do in Forza 7 last year, and his excitement over the Daytona 24 and the Mazda races around it, just recently his experiences with Gran Turismo, I can hear the excitement over good racing and frustration when things go pear-shaped that I have. It's been extremely entertaining watching Rob and Kato learn to crew chief and motorsport manager. I think it would be extremely entertaining to watch Rob and Kato continue Motorsport Mondays with Kato crew chiefing / spotting for Rob as he learns iRacing. I'll explain to you what that is in a minute. I realize that I now work for the company, and it might seem a little self-serving, but my thoughts on this were the same before I worked here. And I think I'm going to take up a, like, I'll take some free code if you got it. Josh is like, I can hook you up, buddy. And I'm like, absolutely, Josh, hook me up. Because iRacing, part of how they do it is it's not cheap. But the Suzuki 10 Hour is coming up at the end of the year, and it was a blast for us last year if you want a goal to shoot for. Have a wonderful day, Josh. That is a wonderful story. I didn't realize that being a steward in iRacing was a growth industry. But I suppose it makes sense because a lot of people got in iRacing over the pandemic. So what he's alluding to there is, it is true, in iRacing, and this is a real world thing, but there are spotters because the aforementioned, sometimes it's hard to see out of a race car. Sometimes it helps to have somebody with binoculars or cameras, like, watching you, and they can tell you what's around you. And in iRacing, that position exists. Somebody can log into your session and basically, like, look around your car and tell you, like, hey, there's somebody, you know, at your 7 o'clock, coming up 8, they're making a move. And so you can, it's most useful on ovals where, like, there's tons of, like, close racing like that and people can be anywhere. But it's kind of useful anywhere. And, I think it could be really a great bonding exercise for me and Kato. You know, I accept on behalf of Kato to sign Kato up to be my spotter as I learn iRacing. Never a driver. No.
No. What?
Let Kato drive? I think not. No. Kato.
I think the fact that you responded that way means that that is explicitly what has to happen, because it would be far more interesting than watching you just do another one of these sims.
You know what? Actually, I'm with Patrick here. Rob, get the fuck out of there. Put Kato behind the wheel.
Mm-hmm. It's Kato time.
Absolutely. Oh, man. What if Kato's really good? That'd be really frustrating. What if I became... Mm-hmm. I was like,
yeah.
I guess I'll work on your setup.
I would love that.
Work
oh,
on
that
your
would
setup,
be so
Kato.
Good. Oh, that would be so good.
All of a
good.
Sudden, Rob is running the stream. He's like, let me mix the audio. Hold on. Oh, you're a little loud. It's Kato stretching his fingers and getting ready to hit the track.
I'm just like, Kato, there's somebody coming up to pass. Kato's like, I know. It's fine. You don't need to give me all these updates. I'm like, okay, just trying to help. That's it.
Just trying to
Yeah, iRacing's super intimidating. It really is. Like the when I played around with it, it was just there's kind of two layers of intimidation. One is that the simulation is, like, really high fidelity. The cars can be really, really demanding. And the other aspect is, and this is why I think people get so dedicated to iRacing. So the job this guy has, like chief steward, iRacing has officials to make sure the racing is good. Like, they supervise. Like, it's not to say you always have to drive like a pro. They understand, like, not everyone's going to be at that tier. But, like, the very highest, like, tiers of iRacing, it basically is, like, you will have real-world racers. You will have, like, really experienced community members all playing. And they want a good race. They don't want people doing dumb shit. That you see, like, in just random matchmaking and consoles. And so to enforce this, this is why people end up paying these subscription fees, is iRacing has, like, officials who will be like, oh, this person fucked up in this race, so we're going to issue them a penalty. It doesn't fix your race, but, like, they don't get to keep the advantage they got from doing this illegal move. And the other thing that they do is, like, at the very highest tiers, they've screened out, like, they appropriately match people, basically. So if you, like, continually are someone who is just can't be trusted out there on track, you will not be matched into the races with like competent drivers. It's tempting, and maybe this is what keeps the wheel out. I've already moved to a, you know, keep the racing wheel out life. Thanks to the Moonlander split keyboard that MK foisted off on me. Having been sold by Renata Price on the virtues of an Ergodox keyboard, MK sprinted ahead of us, got a split keyboard in the Ergodox mold, and then immediately was like, I cannot handle a split keyboard. Fuck this. There is 30 years of muscle memory here with a regular keyboard. This keyboard, this Moonlander, is making me look like a dumbass at work. I cannot handle this.
Wow.
Yeah. Too many typos. too many clumsy oopsies in the work chat. And so now it sort of frames beautifully the little steering wheel that now lives on my desk. So that will do it for today's questions. We have more in the bucket, don't you worry. But I'm just looking for that bucket to fill up with more things that are not about carbonation and coffee and speakers. So again, like you heard it, I'm sure people find Patrick interesting. People have lots of questions for Patrick.
Wow, what is the shittiest possible way to do that pitch?
Jesus Christ.
Send them in. Patrick has lots of...
Cool.
Patrick has tons of thoughts about, like, the direction of the industry, new games. Uh-huh. Like, absolutely. You need to know what Patrick thinks. Write in at gamingadvice.com. Subject question for Patrick.
Did you, like, want me to do something with that bit?
I mean, you're good. So I think that will do it for today's episode. If you want more from Waypoint, you can follow us on Twitter at Waypoint, Facebook and YouTube, Waypoint Vice. You can follow me at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people find you?
I don't know.
Yeah, who cares?
Not sure anymore.
Ren, where can people find you?
People could find me on Twitter at Ren or Raven.
You can also check out what we published on Waypoint.
You can also find me in divorce court next week.
You can check out Patrick's piece on Refund Me If You Can, a two-hour horror game that is itself a pointed critique of Steam refunds. And thanks to Waypoint Plus, Patrick and I are now the Dirty Boys.
The Dirty Boys, yeah.
The
Dirty Boys. DB's in the chat. Let's go.
Now, despite what that may sound like, that actually refers to our growing power washing company in Power Wash Simulator. Patrick, you and I finally took up the mantle to clean this filthy world of ours.
Hell yeah.
And we had a good, long Power Wash Simulator stream. You sort of pitched this as a bit. I'm curious, how did you feel about what you signed yourself up to?
I had a blast. That's some of the most fun I've had on a stream in a while. I don't think I could play that game by myself. I don't think I would find that to be particularly satisfying, but playing that as a co-op thing was just really good. Like the whole arc of as we get towards the end and all the dings are going off, or you're doing the top part of a bridge and I'm doing the bottom, but I'm doing it 30 minutes later, and then we're getting collaborative dings as a result. Just
sort of working delightful. Toward each other delightful. Through a job site. And, yes. Like, yes. Man, that part where... So Power Wash Simulator has, and God, I think could even have more of it. Although I'm not sure real world power washing supports the level of modability that I might be keen to try. But when we saved up, we're not gonna, you know what? We're not buying soaps. We're not buying special nozzle heads. We're gonna save all our money for the bigger power washer, and we got a more powerful one. And, like, when we started hitting the house that we've been cleaning with that instead of the newbie one, it was, like, night and day. It was, like, we were hitting that thing with a fucking sandblaster. just, like, geologic ages just being ripped away by the power of this new washer. And the next map, we got the extended wands so that we didn't have to, like, walk up to stuff as close to, like, hose it down. Mm-hmm. We just stand back, like kings, with, like... a 6-foot water pole.
It was good. It's a very satisfying game. But apparently, also Rob, so in that game, part of the arc of it is that you sort of you're hitting tab to bring up the heat map of the dirt, and then you're using that plus your sort of like trained eye with your equipment to like kind of clean up things, and they ding when you've cleaned it like. Satisfactorily enough in the game, wipes away the whatever small pieces of dirt that you didn't get and just determines it to be clean. And then you kind of like hit escape and there's a spreadsheet of all the things that you've like gotten to like 96% on that you need to go clean up. Apparently in that menu, I don't know exactly what you have to do, but if you click on it, it will highlight those things in the environment. I was reading through a message board thread about the game. with people not realizing that being part of it, and they're like, I played 40 hours of this game, 10 of which might have been desperately searching for where is the...
We were, like, doing forensic analysis of, like, the first home we did, because it was, like...
Well, because we didn't understand that if you mouse over it, it's showing you in the upper... We didn't fully internalize all the little UI elements, which makes me excited for getting back... for the Dirty Boys to get back in it, because knowing all of that... I don't know. Stuff like that, I think, will actually make the game, with the little friction points it even has, like, more satisfying, as we move forward in our... Well, really, your burgeoning business. I'm advancing your career mode.
Right.
I don't get any of the equipment in my game, and I don't know that I have the I think my experience with this game is going to go as far as Rob wants to play it with me, because there's not a chance in hell I'm going to do that playground by myself,
Rob. No, dude, like, even with the two of us, by the end, I was like, I mean, it looks good enough, right? Like, we cleaned that Stegosaur. Yes. Like,
I know the premise here was the kids were getting sick, but, like, less kids are going to get sick now.
It's like good,
right?
Now.
Mission accomplished.
Like, now it just looks like normal dirty. I think we're good.
Let some kids make some judgment calls.
Speaking of streams, Patrick, we're doing that thing Friday, right?
We are. This will. I don't know when this will go live. We have a Nautikato doing the podcast production on this, so the timeline of it is a little bit different. But yes, Ren, do you want to explain what we're going to be doing on Friday?
Yeah, so we were talking about game rentals earlier, and the other day Patrick came to me with a very compelling idea where basically he and I would play through, or like at least play, not play through, different games that each of us had rented over the course of our respective childhoods on stream, and we are going that stick out in our minds in particularly clear ways.
Ways. Just like, oh, this is a game that I thought was really interesting. Couldn't tell you anything about it. Let's use this as an excuse. And I think part of what makes you and I doing this so fascinating is because I think it bucks up against the normal trend of how these go, which is, hey, we're going to play Mega Man 2 or whatever, you know, because, like, that's my touchstone. Because then I prepared the audience. I was like, hey, I think it's, like, a really boring bit to harp on the fact that Ren is, like, much younger than us, but I need you to be prepared for what it means when I tell you we're going to do a feature in which Ren is going to be nostalgic with us. And I was like, I'm not going to... And I told the stream, I was like, not going to tell you all the games that she sent me on a list of 10, but I'm just going to read one of them, and that's going to give you a... And so don't say any other games, Ren.
I was looking at the list.
And I didn't want to give away the one that I leapt on as, like, this is the one we should do.
Wait, you didn't choose the... You're not going to tell them the one that you leapt on?
Well, we can do it now. We can do it now. Okay. This will be but the one I told people is sort of like a tone piece. It's like, one of the games Ren wanted to revisit is a piece of nostalgia for her youth when she was renting games with Sleeping Dogs. And I saw the chat more or less imploded. Rob had a moment. But I thought it was illustrative of what we were talking about here. But please tell the audience the one that I mashed on my keyboard and said, that's the one we should play.
Patrick lost his mind when I said Final Fantasy VII Dirge of Cerberus.
Let us play the shooter spinoff of the Final Fantasy VII franchise. A game I have never played, always wanted to. Love me a little bit of... Fuck, what's his name? Not Shadow. Shit.
He has Shadow the Hedgehog energy.
Well, because it's from that era. Like, that is...
Wait, are we talking about the animal dude?
The vampire. What's his name? Rob, what's his name? Did you play Final Fantasy VII?
Yeah, but wait, who's the vampire? You know, like 13, yeah. Right?
He's an animal.
Right, well, I thought the Shadow the Hedgehog thing was like, I don't remember that guy being a vampire.
No.
I just remember him being a cool animal.
What is this? Can you give... What's the first letter of his name? Ren, can you
I have.
You don't know?
Okay, here's the
Vincent.
Here's the other important thing that I should say about my choice of Final Fantasy VII Dirge of Cerberus. This is another key detail that is going to deeply color this decision.
Okay.
I've never played Final Fantasy VII, nor have I played the Final Fantasy VII remake.
Oh, that's so good. And that's a great way to leave it. That is the feature we are doing. That is the content you can look forward to. And be a regular thing we do going forward. And I think occasionally me dropping in like games that I've like had a similar experience with. And we'll rotate other people in too, but this is what we're going to start with. But I'm very excited to get that started on Friday.
I also streamed F1 22, but nobody needs to watch that stream. I think we can delete that.
Why?
Nobody
no,
needs
Rob,
to see
why?
It. Because, you know, I just didn't, you know, it was...
Rob, you had this moment where you told me to tell our boss it's going to be late to a meeting. Just really, I'm just nailing this race. And then, I don't know, there was like a crash?
The stream crashed.
Yes.
And there was
yes,
no more.
That makes
there was
sense.
No more. So, nobody needs to watch that. But they should check out... I'm going to continue my work of evangelizing Homeworld Deserts of Korok to anybody who will listen. And this week, Ren will have to listen. Or at least, Ren's going to see why I'm so high on this game. And why
I'm a lifelong learner.
Yeah, why it's such a singular little RTS. For our Waypoint Plus listeners, you can listen to Patrick and I discuss the fourth season of Stranger Things, which was... Yeah, just fine if you like that sort of thing, but it turns out Patrick and I do. A lot.
Yes. Yes. Do you want to just listen to us gush while also being like, was that pretty shitty and didn't make a lot of sense? Didn't we eat it and we
this
do it again?
Cheetos aren't food. Crunch, 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 crunch.
Do you want us to just... tell Jonathan Byers, you need to fuck off, man. You ain't relevant to this story anymore. You ain't kissing anybody in
your day
the next
is
season.
Done. King Steve is back.
King Steve. Yeah, so look forward to that. That was really good. That's up now if you're listening to that. It is in the Waypoint Plus feed as we speak.
So if that sounds good, or if you just want more Waypoint, you can go to waypointplus.com and subscribe. It gives you access to our premium feed, but you know, you're also just helping support Waypoint and everything else we do here. If you want to show not just support, but zeal, by all means, go to waypointgeneralstore.com and buy some fine merch. Our theme music is by Bowen. The track is Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Learn more at waypoint.zone/BOEN. For now, we're calling time on this week. We'll talk to you again next week. I think Cod will be producing that one. We're just going to give him some files because he comes back on Tuesday. So it's like, welcome,
right.
Welcome back. Edit this.
Right.
Eat your files, nerd.
Yeah.
Take a big chomp of your files, dork.
Hey. We just went wild here, okay? We just left all our fans and ACs on. I don't care what your noise gate settings are. Who gives a shit? Good luck, Kato.
Ren yelled and cried for 6 consecutive minutes.
You cut around that? But also leave a little bit of it in. There was a good bit in the middle of it. Just, like, duck the crying. But get the bit.
Yeah. Come on, Kato.
So look forward to that. But until then, fuck capitalism. Go home.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.